Good evening, everyone, and welcome back to Religious Zionism. Took a bit of a break. Today, I'd like to tackle a very, very charged topic, and that is the topic of land for peace, which we'll get to in just a second. And before we get to that, though, I'd like to finish a discussion we began having in our last session. So for a bit of background, for those who may not have been with us the entire time, during the series, we've essentially discussed a number of different issues relating to religious Zionism generally, and began with certain philosophical outlooks. How should we look at the movement to establish a sovereign Jewish nation in the Holy Land? Is that mainly a political movement? Is it mainly to combat anti-Semitism? Is it much more fundamental? Is it an expression of our innermost national self? Is it about bringing Mashiach? So these are some of the questions we dealt with at the beginning of the series. And then more recently, we dealt with more specific issues. One was something we'll relate to today again, which was that of the question of the three oaths talked about in the Gemara, which asks the question of whether we are to begin the process of returning to Israel by ourselves, or should we wait until Hashem sends us some sort of sign from heaven in order to return? And that was a few weeks ago. And last week, we started talking about the commandment of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, the commandment of settling the land of Israel. And what we established last week, I'd like to review that for a bit and then get to one of the issues that we left off with last week, which I hope to pick up with this week, is that there is both an individual and national obligation to settle the land of Israel according to the Ramban. Namely that individually, this is not what I want to focus on, but there is a mitzvah for each person, man or woman, to immigrate to the land of Israel and live there. That's one mitzvah. But even more fundamentally, there is a mitzvah, according to the Ramban, for the Jewish nation as a whole to conquer the land of Israel, but not only to conquer it, conquering enough, after we conquer it, we need to settle in the land of Israel. We need to live there. And if you look at source number one and two, I brought this for you again in this week's source sheet. If you look at source number one, it's just the psukim from Bamidbar, where the Torah describes the obligation, number one, to conquer the land from all the idolatrous inhabitants. And number two, we have the commandment of V'horashtem et ha'aretz v'yishavtem bah. You shall conquer the land and dwell there. And this is where the Ramban says in source number two, I'll read it in English, we have been commanded to conquer the land Hashem has given to our forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and not leave it in the hands of another nation or leave it desolate. And he elaborates and says, do not think that this is the same thing as conquering the land. Do not think that the only obligation is to take the army and at first conquer the land. That's the first step. But after we conquer it, we need to live there. It is a mitzvah. It's not a one-time deal. It is an internal mitzvah. We need to make sure that it is in Jewish hands, and we need to make sure that it is inhabited by the Jewish people. That is something we proved last week. We discussed how there are those who dispute this. The Rambam happens to not count this mitzvah, but we proved last week, I'm not going to go everything, that this has very important halachic ramifications, such as the Gemara, which states that you can even violate Shabbat on a rabbinic level to ensure the purchase of a house in Israel from a non-Jew, so that you can have someone write up a contract for you to ensure that you will be able to keep a house in Israel that you are purchasing from a non-Jew. The reason for that, many of the commentaries explain, is because this is a very important mitzvah that doesn't just affect any individual person, but affects the national mission. So that when I buy one house in Israel, that's not just for me. That's for the Jewish people, because now the Jewish people have control of one more place in Israel.
Rambam agrees?
Does everybody agree to that? Is that what you asked?
The Rambam agrees.
Yes, the Rambam agrees to the last thing I quoted, that you are allowed to, again, I'm not going to get into the specifics, whether or not you can write the contract, you have someone write it for you. Do you actually buy the land, or have you bought the land before Shabbat, and you're simply writing a contract that will prove that you bought the land? But the Rambam does agree that that's true, that you can violate Shabbat in order to settle the land, and which would to indicate that at least practically we do think that there is still a national mandate to settle the land of Israel.
So this, why do you have to buy the house if you've conquered the land?
What'd you say?
Why do you have to buy the house if you've conquered the land?
That's an excellent question. Why do you need to buy the house if you conquered the land? So to that, well, actually, I think we'll see in a second, but we spoke last week about the different elements of this mitzvah, and that buying houses and the like, although they may not be the end goal of living in the land, right? But they enable it. You can't live in a land if you don't have houses or you don't have any sort of infrastructure, right? So things like buying houses and the like are part of the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Maybe not, you know, the end goal of having people live there, but it's important in order to live there. If you don't have houses, then you can't live there.
So I think my issue is if you've conquered, why would you buy?
Okay, so this is the question, Paul. This is the question. So Paul asks, if you conquer, why would you buy? So here's the issue in front of us today, and which we still have to explore, which is, should we draw a line between conquering / sovereignty / autonomy and inhabiting and living? Because you could separate them. One question would be, what if you had quote unquote political control over the land, but there were many other people who have there are other nations, say Arabs or, you know, the Druze, or other nations that have control of specific communities within the country. So what's the nature of that? Meaning Israel has some sort of control over the whole land, or much of the land, let's say, for now. But within that control, there are certain communities which are not governed directly by the state of Israel. Or the flip side, what if many, many Jewish people lived in Israel, but they were not under their own control? Say before 1948. Right, where you had many Jewish people immigrating to Israel, but there was no Jewish government. They did not have autonomy. It was under the British mandate. Did they fulfill this national mitzvah of living in the land of Israel? So should we emphasize autonomy, or should we emphasize physically living there? That's the question I want to get. I think that relates to your question, Paul. Why buy a house if you conquered it? You conquered it, but there are still other people living there that don't necessarily, you know, agree to your control over them, right? Like that's something that we encounter nowadays. So that's part of the question. How much is this about autonomy? How much is it not about autonomy? It's not about what we call in Hebrew ribonut. It's about being there. As long as the Jews live there, then that's okay. Understand the question? Any thoughts before we go on? How important do you think that autonomy is to this mitzvah? Autonomy per se, based on what we've seen.
Well, I think you have a real problem if you want to live in today's civilization. We have international rules. We have the United Nations for what it's worth. It's, you know, yes. I mean, let's not get into the United Nations, but we do have the United Nations. You do have Arab neighbors who have big bombs and may even have nuclear weapons, who if you start conquering, they may let them off and you may end up with nothing. And you also have superpowers in this world that control a lot of armaments. And if we don't have a friendly United States and we have a belligerent Russia or a belligerent Iran, where do we end up? We end up nowhere.
So that's a great question. Let me, since you raised that point, which we're going to get to, those are all really good points. So let me ask you a question. If the question will be as follows, if everything you said is true, does that mean that we don't really have control? Meaning if the argument that Paul just made essentially is follows, look, regardless of what the Torah, I hate making this like clause, but I guess I'll say it. Even if the Torah commands us to do something, we can't necessarily do that. we can't. Let's say the state of Israel cannot necessarily, for instance, rid itself of idolatry because international law dictates that we need to respect people's right to their own religions. And all the other things Paul mentioned, does that take away from our mitzvah as a nation of Yishev Eretz Yisrael if we have those limitations? Now, I would argue the more that you focus on autonomy, the more that becomes relevant, right? Because maybe to have true autonomy means that I can do what I want because it's my land. So this is the question I want to sort of study today. And I think it will have relevance to the question of land for peace, which again is really, really, really complex. But I'd like to explore some of the...
There's no contradiction. You can have both autonomy and Yishuv.
You could, but what if you don't? That's my question. What if you don't?
What if you don't?
What autonomy you have Yishuv?
We have an obligation to get both, maybe?
You could. So that's the question, right? This is exactly the point. To what degree do we have an obligation to get both? That's the point. Let me, to throw it out there, right? Obviously, this is relevant to some of the discussions. And again, there are many geopolitical issues that are involved, aside from the halachic and philosophical ones, which I'm not necessarily going to focus on. But if, for instance, if we discuss a two-state solution, right? So how problematic is it to have another state within the confines of the greater land of Israel? So if you focus on autonomy, it might be very problematic, right? Because the point is, that's not autonomy. If there's another state, then we don't have autonomy over that state. That's the whole point.
But isn't there, for example, isn't there a Buddhist colony in Tel Aviv or somewhere?
Okay, right. These are the questions.
And they have idols.
Right.
According to their religion.
Exactly. Okay. So these are the questions we need to address. In terms of
what kind of community was that community sharing idols? I didn't hear.
Is that I think Baha'i is Paul's referring to.
Baha'i.
Okay. So let's look at some of the sources here. Let's look at sources. So here I want to first start off with what I think is a distinction between two modern day commentators, one a little bit older, but Tzitz Eliezer. And in source number 3, and Rabbi Elazar Melamed in source number 4. And I think you'll see that Tzitz Eliezer is de-emphasizing the factor of autonomy, whereas Rabbi Elazar Melamed is emphasizing the autonomy factor, that for him it's very important. I think you'll see that was put in the source sheet again. In the chat, but I think you'll see that. Take a look at source number 3. It's Tzitz Eliezer. Eliezer Waldenberg, well-known posek in the 20th century in Israel. And this is his point, essentially. His point is as follows. Some people could argue, maybe living in Israel is a means to an end. You could have argued. Meaning, what does that mean, a means to an end? Maybe the purpose of living in Israel is essentially so that we can get sovereignty. That you could have suggested the more people are there, the more likely it is that we'll have control over the land. And that's the reason the Torah asks us to live there. And it's Tzitz Eliezer says, absolutely not. That is not so. The point isn't just autonomy, such that even though we now have a state of Israel, and we have a degree of autonomy that doesn't take away at all from the obligation upon the Jewish people to immigrate to Israel and settle the land. That obligation is just as relevant as it always was. That's the argument he makes here in source number 3. I'll read it in English. Now, it comes to the main goal of this article. To clarify and prove according to Halacha that the obligation to immigrate to Eretz Yisrael and its mitzvah and settlement was not damaged at all with the establishment of the state and the attainment of sovereignty in a certain party area. On the contrary, it has grown even more in value, and every one of the Israelis living, or the Jews, it should say, living in the diaspora is charged more with fulfilling its obligation. Right? That's his point. There's more of an obligation now that we have a state. And if you look at the third paragraph, for the sake of time, because we have a lot to cover here, if you look at the third paragraph, I'll read it where I have the bold in English. The obligation to immigrate and settle is not conditional on obtaining sovereignty in the country. They're not conditional upon each other. If you live in Israel, you get the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Israel, even if you don't have political sovereignty. Even if you're governed by the British Mandate or the Ottoman Empire, when the Jewish people move to Israel, that is a mitzvah. That's the point he's making here. There are those who think that since the part we already conquered was immediately taken out of Gentile control and is in our sole possession, there is no longer an obligation to immigrate and settle in it, since in between it's already under our feet. But they are greatly mistaken, because the commandment of Aliyah to hold on to the land has no contact at all with the commandments of conquering, and they are two separate commandments. Just as we were commanded in the Torah about conquering, so we were especially commanded to settle the land. So the point is, there's conquering. Conquering is about autonomy, but then there's settling, and never the twain shall meet. You get a mitzvah simply by living there. Okay? Clear? That is the Tzitz Eliezer. Rav Elazar Melamed, who's a posek nowadays in Israel, in Pnei Halacha, seems to have a very different perspective. And his argument is that really the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is about not just living there. It's about having a sovereign nation in the land. It's about having ribonut, having authority, having our control of the land. That's what the mitzvah really is. Take a look at what he says here. He's writing about Yom HaAtzma'ut and the importance of Israel Independence Day. He says, "B'yom hei b'iyar b'chamish zalafim tafshin chet," on the 5th of Iyar in 5708, based on the our count from creation of the world, at the time of declaration of the state, the people of Israel merited after 2,000 years of exile to keep the commandment to settle the land. When did we finally fulfill the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael? On Yom HaAtzma'ut, on the day independence was declared. The government's declaration of independence and assertion of sovereignty fulfilled a mitzvah in and of itself. For at the time of the declaration of the state, Israeli sovereignty was applied to parts of the land of Israel, and thus we began to observe the mitzvah that the land would be in our hands and not in the hands of another nation. And he echoes the quote there of the Ramban, that the sovereignty is the point. The fact that we controlled Israel is the fulfillment of the mitzvah to settle the land. They are intertwined. That is inherently significant, to have sovereignty. And he tells a story here, I'll just quote it out for you outside in source number 2, the name of Tzvi Yehuda Cook. Or Tzvi Yehuda Cook, we discussed before, he's the son of Rav Avraham Yitzchak, like a Kohen Cook, and a leader, really, in the religious Zionist movement in Israel in the 20th century. And he talks about how at the yeshiva of Rav Cook, Merkaz Arav, there was a celebration of Yom HaAtzma'ut. And the Rebbeim were discussing why it's significant. And one of the rabbis in the yeshiva says, you know why it's significant that we have a state? Because now that we have a state, people are going to keep mitzvot, and they're going to keep Shabbat, and they're going to learn Torah. And that's why it's significant. It'll be easier to do all those things. And Tzvi Yehuda said, it's not just that. That's not the point. That independence in and of itself is a value. The fact that we have a sovereign nation, aside from all the wonderful thing that will lead to, having a sovereign nation in our land is in itself the value of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. That was his point. So you see here, there's really, I think we'll see this play itself out, there's really a split in philosophy in terms of looking at Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Is Yishuv Eretz Yisrael primarily about inhabitants, about living in the land, which you could say is more of a religious obligation? It's, you know, the land of Israel is our homeland. It was promised to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, but it's important that we be there. Or is it more than that? It's about setting up a nation. It's about establishing a nation in the land. It's about owning and controlling the land. Or both. Obviously, both can be true, but you have two different emphases here. And source number 5, I bring Rav Cook, and the purpose of bringing Rav Cook is to sort of see the philosophical importance of this notion that this dream and vision of settling the land and the importance of it is so essential that it even in certain ways can allow for certain leniencies in other areas. Rav Kook famously allowed certain leniencies when it came to observing Shemitah, the seventh sabbatical year. And then he allowed certain leniencies in order for that to happen. Hetzer Mechira is the famous one where he allowed the temporary sale of the land of Israel to non-Jews in order so that those lands will not be subject to the laws of Shemitah. He had a number of leniencies. And Rav Kook writes here, why is he being lenient? Because we need to get people back. We need them back. That's the first step. The first step is getting the Jewish people back in the land of Israel. After we do that, and if we can do that, then we can start thinking about the appropriate way to observe halacha. But the first step is getting people back. Look what he writes here. Tachata yishuv hu inyan shel doro. The goal of settlement is a matter of generations. Aydei chizak ha-yishuv ha-tarhitrabut achinu be-Yisrael be-Eretz ha-Kodesh tiyah gula be-karov yoter. The increase of our brothers, the house of Israel, in the Holy Land will ultimately bring redemption closer. Kizehu pashut shahagula tluya berinoi achinu am kadosh be-Eretz ha-Kadosh. That it is simple, it is clear that the final redemption is contingent upon many of our brothers settling the holy nation, settling in the holy land. Once everyone gets back, we'll be able to fulfill everything. Cook says, this is similar to the case where the Gemara says, in order to save someone's life, you can violate Shabbat. Why? One of the rationales for that is that if you save this person's life, they'll keep many Shabbatot. So you can violate one Shabbat in order that they continue to keep Shabbat for many years. And Rav Kook says, in the same way, we can be lenient to allow people to return to the land of Israel and be lenient in certain halachot, because by having them return, that is the key, and then we'll be able to do everything the way we want to. Okay, so we had this notion of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael in two different emphases, on autonomy versus on just simply getting people back. And now I'd like to finally get into the notion of land for peace. It's a really very involved topic that involves a lot of issues. Let me begin by asking you as follows, okay? And we're going to make the following assumption. Land for peace involves two factors, right? There's the land part and there's the peace part. So the second part, the peace part, is something that, you know, really just depends on the reality. And many and all the rabbis that we're going to study today essentially say, look, if there isn't going to be peace, regardless of what we do, if there is no negotiating partner that will allow for any sort of Jewish state in the land of Israel, then we have nothing to talk about. Land for peace is only a discussion if it will actually result in peace. If it won't result in peace, then this is all irrelevant. So that's clearly the case. But say it was, we lived in a different world, for argument's sake, and say there was a strong, and I don't think it's true nowadays, but say there was a strong presence of our neighbors, the Palestinians, who would agree to living side by side with us, you know, if we gave them more land to live in. Let's make that assumption, because or else it's the whole thing is irrelevant. Let's make the assumption that they would accept peace and no longer attack us if we would give them land back such that they can have contiguous borders and have more free movement in their own territory. Would or should halacha allow for such a thing? Should halacha allow the Jewish people to give up territories in the land of Israel in order to achieve peace? What factors would come into play in your mind in making that decision? If you put your prime minister hat on and your rabbi hat on, and you have a choice.
I think the issue is that we cannot give back a gift. God gave us a gift. How can we, is it under our authority to betray God's gift?
Okay, so God gave us the gift of Israel. He said it's ours. How can we give it back?
Rabbi?
Yes, Charlie.
Can you just tell us what are the boundaries of this land that we're talking about?
Okay, so I think what you're getting at is, does it depend on like inside the Green Line or outside the Green Line? Is that what you're getting at?
Also, what are the boundaries of the land as stated in the Torah?
So that's a really good question, which I'm not going to get into. Say, for argument's sake, we're talking about land that is included in the Torah. Let's say, for argument's sake, we're talking about land that is included. Yehuda and Shomron, let's say. So we can argue about whether that's, has the sanctity of Eretz Yisrael nowadays because of the fact that maybe we didn't conquer it the second time we came back, but it's certainly included in the Torah.
No doubt about that.
Why do you have to conquer it twice? Isn't the first time enough?
That's a really good question. It's not necessarily the truth. That's actually an argument in the Rishonim as to whether or not when we lost Israel the first time, did the land lose its sanctity along with our exile from the land? That's a great question. But let's say, for argument's sake, we're talking about Eretz Israel proper, the land of Israel. We're talking about a land where the Torah clearly does delineate that this land is within the borders of Israel. The question is, am I allowed to give it up if I have an honest partner who will say, if you give me this land, then we'll leave you alone? Any argument's pro.
The Torah says v'chai bohem.
Okay, and, good.
Right? But on the other hand, that shouldn't necessarily apply for everything, right? When you got an outright gift, maybe it's different.
Okay, so Mara makes a great point. So this is essentially the question, right? So we do generally say that in order to save lives, you can break any mitzvah in the Torah, except for the cardinal three sins, except for idolatry, adultery, and murder. Aside from that, you are allowed to, and if it will save lives, you can violate any mitzvah in the Torah. Correct? That is the generally the halacha. So if it's certainly conquering the land or Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is very important, but what if giving some of that back will save lives? That's one question. Furthermore, how much of a hit does Yishuv Eretz Yisrael take if we give some land back? How much of a concession is that? What are we losing by giving back some land? It's another question. So I want to address some of the issues here. I don't want this to be too source heavy, but I'm sorry. I'm just going to try to move on a bit here. And let me just preface as follows. There's two main issues to contend with, the positive and the negative issue. The positive issue is we do have, as we just discussed, a positive commandment to conquer the land of Israel and to settle the land. And it would seem that giving up the land of Israel would be against that notion, would be against the notion of the positive mitzvah of settling the land of Israel. So that's one question we have to contend with. Are we allowed
also give up on sovereignty at the same
time? Exactly. Sovereignty. We're giving up potentially sovereignty. We might be giving up actual possession of the land. And how heavy does that factor weigh? The other factor, which I want to get to next week, really, is the negative factor. That there are commandments in the Torah of we are commanded not to give up the land of Israel to at least certain Gentiles. We're not supposed to give away the land. There's a law called Lo Techanim, and we shouldn't give away encampment in the land of Israel unless there are certain conditions involved. And also, there's a general prohibition against allowing idolaters to live in the land of Israel. But I want to talk about that next week. That's the negative aspect. Today, for the next few minutes, I just want to focus on Yishuv Eretz Yisrael versus peace. Can we give up to some degree the notion of selling the land of Israel in order to live in peace with our neighbors? Again, assuming that we would. So here, I essentially want to focus on an argument between two great Israeli rabbis who wrote an article in Chumen. Chumen is a very well-known periodical given out in Israel. It's also available online if you register for it. And in this periodical, say about 32 years ago, there were two articles written about this question by Rav Avadja Yosef. Rav Avadja was one of the great Sephardic scholars in Israel of his generation. We just lost him a few years ago, an absolute brilliant man, although I would not say that he necessarily identified as a Zionist. He did not. He wasn't anti the state of Israel, but he also certainly was in the Haredi world. And Rav Shaul Yisraeli, who was more of a religious Zionist rabbi and thinker. And they argue about this question. And I'd like to just explore some of the issues that they argue about along with some other issues. And so at least I think we're not going to explore them completely, but we can appreciate some of the issues involved in this question, which I think still play out today. Because these questions are still very relevant. How, you know, in terms of how much we should be looking to negotiate, how much we should be proactive in looking for peace, if it involves negotiating with our land. So these are some of the issues I want to discuss. The first issue I want to go over very briefly, but it is relevant. And that is an issue we dealt with in a few shiurim ago, the issue of the Shalosh Shavuot, the three oaths. Right? If you look in source number six, there are three oaths mentioned in this Gemara. Two of them are for the people of Israel, where God, so to speak, made the people of Israel swear, number one, that they wouldn't rebel against the rule of the nations of the world. And number two, that they should, the first one, that they should not ascend to Eretz Israel as a wall, meaning we're not meant to conquer the land of Israel by force. Now, if you remember, we dealt with these oaths a few weeks ago, and we gave many different reasons as to why, according to many opinions, they may no longer be applicable, right? However, that being said, Rav Avadja says in source number seven that they do still have some relevance. And his argument is as follows. The Gemara says we're not supposed to rebel against the nations of the world. This relates to something Paul said before. What if we have international law which does not consent to some of the actions made by the Israeli government? Which we do, right? That's clearly the case. Rav Avadja Yosef argues that to go against the consent of the nations of the world would not be a performance of this mitzvah. He argues as follows in source number seven. Rav Avadja essentially arguing is the point that, let me take a step back. On the one hand, we have, let me take for some background here. I know there's a lot here, but this is an important issue to understand. On the one hand, we have the notion that saving lives takes precedence over everything, right? You can do anything to save a life. You can violate Shabbat to save a life. You can, you know, Yom Kippur to save a life. You can do anything to save a life. But there is a mitzvah. There is a notion of milchemet mitzvah. There are certain wars we need to fight. And the very notion of war means that you're going to lose lives. So, for instance, a defensive war. If another nation attacks the people of Israel, there's an obligation for Israel to defend themselves. That's called Melchemet Mitzvah, a divinely mandated war. Clearly, you can't say, well, look, if it's to save lives, we're not going to fight. Clearly, if war is necessary, it means you need to do it, even though obviously in a war you might lose lives. So Rav Avadja is essentially questioning, look, if we're going to say we are obligated to fight to ensure that we maintain possession of the land of Israel, then doesn't that mean that we can't give up land for peace? Because you can't say, I want to save lives if it means defending Israel. Defending Israel is one of those things you have to fight for, to which Rav Avadja says, not necessarily. And his first point is, why not? Because the Gemara said we can't rebel against the nations of the world. And if the nations of the world are saying that there are certain territories they do not want us to inhabit, then we lose the obligation to risk our lives to defend those territories. That's his argument in story number 7. He says, we see based on this Gemara in story 6, that even according to the Ramban, there is no mitzvah in our day to go out to war and risk lives to retain the territories which we conquered against the authority of the nations of the world. Ravaji would say the saying that international law plays a big role here. If international law dictates that we're not meant to live in a certain area of Israel, then we are not obligated to risk our lives to defend that land. Okay? Understood? Which is really quite an interesting point here. Rishali Yisraeli rejects this completely. And again, I don't want to necessarily focus on this point so much because we focused on it last time. Rishali Yisraeli makes 2 points. One is the 3 oaths are no longer applicable. Anyone remember one of the reasons why the 3 oaths are no longer applicable in terms of rebelling against the nations of the world?
The UN vote.
Exactly. The UN voted in 1947 to give the Jewish people permission to return to the land of Israel. So with that, Rav Shlomo Yisraeli argues these oaths are no longer binding. Number one, he also argues, what if now the UN is asking us to give all sorts of land back? He says, no, that's not how it works. The point is, once they gave us permission to return to the land of Israel, the mitzvah applied once again in its totality. They can't simply say, like Rav Avadj is suggesting, no, we take it back. That's not within their purview. Once the oaths no longer apply, they no longer apply. That's number one. Okay? And he argues here that, therefore, even you can't, and he makes the point of Rav Avadj, wait a minute. So you're really going to say that all the places the UN decides we need to give up, we no longer have to defend? That's going to include a lot of things, including Jerusalem itself, right? Think about it. He makes this point for Rav Avadj and his Shuva. The UN, international law, does not recognize Jewish sovereignty over all of Jerusalem. It actually wants us to give back much of East Jerusalem. So he says, Rav Avadj, are you willing to give that back too? Because the UN said so. So that's one contention. What role does international law and what the United Nations and other nations of the world dictate about Jewish sovereignty or what the Jews have the right to, what role does that play here? For Rav Avadj, it is relevant based on the 3 oaths. For the Rambam, for Shlomo Yisraeli, no, absolutely not. 3 oaths are no longer applicable. We had the right to the land of Israel. They gave us permission. And now every single land that we conquered falls under the purview of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, such that we need to fight to defend it. That's point one in this discussion. The role, essentially, of international law in taking away the mandate of Mohammed Mitzvah. It's another really interesting point here that Rav Avadj brings up and that is disputed I wanted to talk about. And that is in terms of this notion of Mohammed Mitzvah. What is a divinely mandated war? Again, what's at stake here is, if it's a divinely mandated war, then we can't say we're not going to do it for peace. Because war means you're going to lose lives. By definition, if God's telling us you need to fight this type of war, we can't say we're not going to do it because we want to save lives. That's our obligation, is to fight it and do the best that we can. So there's another question as to whether or not this is still applicable. And that is the role of the king. The role of the king. This is a really great, a big topic, but I want to focus on it specifically. We know that in the Torah, there is a mitzvah to appoint a king. A mitzvah of minoy melech, appointing a king over the nation. And one of the roles of the king is to decide when the nation goes to war. That's one of the king's roles. The king would ask the Kohen Gadol. The Kohen Gadol had a very unique method of counseling with God and asking the Urim Bitumim, the stones on the Choshen Mishpat that would light up. And if the Kohen Gadol got the okay, then the king would go to war. Says Rav Avadj Yosef in source number 9, we do no longer have a king. We no longer have a king. We no longer have a high priest. And based on that, we no longer have this divine mandate to go to war. Again, therefore, we don't have to risk our lives to defend Eretz Israel and these territories, because it's not a Mohammed Mitzvah without a king.
Rabbi?
What would you respond to that? You have a response to that, Charlie, the lack of a king?
No, I was going to ask a question here. I always
ask go for questions.
Now you've made me forget it. Just a second.
I'm sorry. My bad.
In the Torah, there is no mitzvah to go to war for land, is there?
To go to war for land, there is. There's a mitzvah to conquer the land of Israel. That's going to take war. If everybody would say, okay, like, it's yours, and they're willing to live in peace with us, then it wouldn't require necessarily kivush.
Well,
but if they don't, yeah, you have to fight. There's such a thing as Mohammed Mitzvah.
Well, wasn't that Yehoshua's role to do and not anybody else in the future?
So that's what we're arguing that's not so. We're arguing that was not just one time historical occurrence. There's an eternal mitzvah to conquer the land of Israel. That's what part of this discussion is predicated upon, right?
Okay.
So we're arguing, and that's one. And two, sometimes these wars are defensive, right? But how might you respond to the lack of king, a lack of a king? So, you know, for time's sake, I'll respond instead. Rav Shaul Yisraeli quotes from Cook in source number 10. And the question is, look, what do we do without a king? How does a nation govern itself? We don't have a king. So what are you going to say? We can no longer govern ourselves? So Rav Cook suggests, no, that when there is no king, national decisions which affect the welfare of the nation, that right is returned to the nation as a whole. That there is a system of governance without kingship, without monarchy, says Rav Cook in source number 10. So the point is, this is another really interesting issue. How does decision-making for a nation of Israel work? Rav Avadja is arguing for a very traditional sort of, you know, biblical sort of perspective, that the way it's supposed to work is we have a king, we have a Kohen Gadol. Now, he's not saying you can't have a government, but he's saying it's not considered a mechemet mitzvah, quote-unquote, if you don't have those things. Rav Shaul Yisraeli says, no, those things are ideal, maybe. But they don't take away the ability of a nation to decide it's a mitzvah for it to go to war.
In the old days, there was...
Without a king, we have national consensus. And national consensus can be reached based on a democratically elected government. Such that if the, you know, Israeli government suggests that now it is in the best interests of the nation to go to war, then they have that right. That is then a Mohammed mitzvah. So what power does the government or the people have now without a king is another really interesting question to consider.
And without God's input. Because
Exactly.
Yeah, but through the Hoshe and through the Kohen.
We don't have that input. So where does that leave us? Yeah. Right? And I think this, again, the big issue here, I think part of it is, you know, we for thousands of years, we didn't have this. What changes now that we have a nation in our land and we have a responsibility to take care of our people? Do we sort of have to, are we still locked into some of the, you know, forms of government that are related in the Bible? Or do we say, even if they're ideal, we no longer have them, but we still have to function as a nation? That's another element. The next element is one that I really want to focus on, and that relates to what we discussed until now. Limited control of the land. Ravaggio Sage makes the following argument, source number 11. He makes the argument that, as Paul referenced before, we don't have full autonomy over our land. We don't. We can't just kick out people when we want to. We can't just rid the land of idolatry if we want to. We're bound by many geopolitical factors. We're bound by international law. We're bound by the powers, the nations around us, the superpowers in the world that are incredibly powerful that we can't afford to have, antagonism toward. We have to reckon with the diplomacy toward other nations too. So says Rav Avadja that because of our limited control over the land of Israel, as wonderful as it is to have a nation, because of our limited control, because the Palestinians are living in the land of Gaza and are living in the West Bank, and we can't just kick them out because that will have horrific geopolitical consequences. At least this is what he writes 32 years ago. That means that we don't have the full-fledged mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. It's lacking. And since it's lacking to begin with, we don't need to lose our lives to defend the specific lands in question. The lack of full autonomy takes away the stakes of defending the land of Israel, such that, again, I don't think Rav Hajj is saying that we have to get rid of all of them. But his point is, since we lack full autonomy, we can't do what we want. We're bound to international law and all sorts of geopolitical pressures. That means that we can't say that every single land is necessary to die for. That's his point. If we had all of that, then we could say it's a Mohammed mitzvah. Since we don't, it's not. So that's a really interesting point.
Yeah.
Well, how much do you respond to that point? Say that again, Martin.
The other side must argue against him, right?
Absolutely. How would you argue against him, though?
To say that we need to go to war, even if we have this limited autonomy.
Right. So I think number one, it reverts back to our original discussion: is Yishuv Eretz Yisrael contingent upon autonomy, or is it not? Do we say that every single land that we can live in is still a mitzvah? Or do we say that no, because we can't control some of the land to begin with, then it's not a mitzvah? It relates to that. But it also relates to another issue. What is the nature of being bound by geopolitical forces or international law? And does that really take away from our autonomy? And here, Vishal Yisraeli says, no, it doesn't. Every nation has to deal with international law and geopolitical factors. Now, look, there might be some nations that are more powerful than others, but every nation is quote unquote bound by international law. That doesn't take away from their autonomy. The fact that America can't do certain things or Canada can't do certain things because of international law shouldn't take away from its autonomy. He writes as follows in source number 12. His proof is, the Ramban said, and here's the historical proof, the Rachmanides argued that there's a mitzvah to settle and conquer the land of Israel eternally, in every generation. How can that even be so if it's only applicable when we have full autonomy? The Hashmonaim, the Hasmonean kings, didn't have full autonomy in that way. When the Jews returned with Ezra, when they came back from Babylon to rebuild the second temple, they didn't have full autonomy in the way Rav Avadja describes. There's a reality of having a nation where you have certain limitations. That's part of being a nation in the world. And he proves it from a Rambam. Take a look at source number 12. First of all, he makes the point. What is the flaw that we do not evict the Arabs, that they sit safely in their courts and castles? Do we want to harass them? After all, we're only interested in their sitting quietly. It's not that we need to kick them out. We don't want to kick them out. We just want them to be peaceful. That's not a flaw in our autonomy. Having neighbors that we want to be peaceful with us and an inability to kick them out doesn't mean we don't have any sort of sovereign nation. And he argues further. The Rambam writes as follows in Avodah Zarah, right? As we referenced a few times, we'll get to more next week, and it's a sticky topic, not an easy topic at all. But we're not supposed to allow for idolatry in the land of Israel. That is a biblical law. We're not supposed to allow for idolaters or idolatry to be worshipped in the land of Israel. There's a commandment to rid Israel of all idols and idolatry. But the Rambam says, when is that? It's biyad, when yadenu tkifa al ha'umot. When we have a strong hand. When we have a strong hand, then we're obligated to rid the land of Israel of idolatry. What is that factor of having a strong hand? So you could say, the point is, because if we don't, it's too dangerous. Rishonim Yisraeli says, no, that's not the point. That's obvious. Of course that's true. Of course. But that's obvious. That goes without saying. It's more than that. The point is that we have a sort of political obligation to maintain diplomacy with the nations around us. That's the point. In an environment where we have that regard, we have that obligation, where we do have to take geopolitical factors into account, then even if we're not going to die, right? And this is an important point, because the point is, no one would say that we cannot, that Israel cannot maintain what they have now for security reasons. Israel is capable of securing the settlements in Judea and Samaria. They're capable of doing that. But the point is, Israel might not do other things because we have to take into account geopolitical considerations. But that's part of the mitzvah itself. That doesn't mean we can't do it. The mitzvah itself allows for those considerations. So the Shai Israeli is saying, another point, in the modern world, we have to, that geopolitical considerations, taking into account what other nations will think and maintaining diplomacy, is part of the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. It doesn't take away from it. We wouldn't say we don't have Yishuv Eretz Yisrael simply because of these factors. So that's another point to consider. Okay, a few more points before we sort of wrap this up. I know there's a lot here. Take a look at source number 13. The loss of life in war. Mavaj Edenbrinker makes the following point. He quotes a story from Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was a prominent Rosh Yeshiva in the very end of the 19th century. Very, very well-known rabbi. And Rabbi Soloveitchik, the story goes that Rabbi Soloveitchik said, someone went to him and said, Rabbi Soloveitchik, aren't you, if Mashiach comes, a lot of people are going to die. And Rabbi Soloveitchik said, look, if it means losing a life, if it means losing lives, Jewish lives, then I don't need Mashiach to come. It's really a pretty radical statement. And Ravaj is sort of assuming, he quotes Rabban's effect, that the hope is that when Mashiach comes, we won't have to lose so many lives. Mashiach comes, he quotes Rabban that it will ultimately be that the nations of the world will accept Mashiach, and that it won't involve the loss of so much Jewish life. And the Rishali Yisrael says, no, that's not how it works. The Rambam writes that when Mashiach comes, he's going to need to fight the wars of God. Having a country sometimes requires war. War requires the loss of life. That's the way it works. It's not realistic to expect to be able to maintain a sovereign nation and at the same time never lose any lives. Even Mashiach's going to have to fight war, says Rishali Yisraeli. Take a look at source number 13. Mikol makom hilachim matarazim, to fight for this goal. Hiya mahama shal Ezra Yisrael miyad tsar, which means the war, to protect Israel from its enemies, shi mitzvah. From Revor b'devir Rambam, shem melech ha-mashiach hilachim mahama shal Hashem. In kein gam mahama otam bitachin shukrochim b'avdu nefasho. No, maybe the war is Mashiach will fight, ultimately will involve the loss of lives. But he still won't refrain from engaging in those battles. So I think what we see here in this dispute is sort of a difference in perspective. That Rav Avadja Yosef, essentially what I would argue, adopts a very, we'll say, I'll say traditional or old-fashioned perspective. That we look at the sources and we think, like, what should we do, as we always did, right? So we need a melech, we need a king, we need Urim Bitumim, we have to worry about nations of the world, and if we can't have our own state that's in totally in our control, then it's not Yishuv Eretz Yisrael at all. And Rishali Yisraeli is arguing, I think, for a more progressive look on this, in the sense that part of religious Zionism is that now that we have a state, factors have changed. Things have changed. We need to think differently. We need to think about governance differently. We need to think about war and the loss of life differently. We need to think about geopolitical relationships differently. that's not a contradiction to the notion of having a sovereign nation, is dealing with the nation, the surrounding nations. And it's just two different perspectives on looking at this. And related to, you know, does it have to be an all or nothing proposition, or can we have some part, some sovereignty, but not total sovereignty, some of Israel, but not all of Israel, but that still needs to be defended. I want to just, and these are all very big issues that can't totally, you know, obviously be encapsulated in one class. I want to touch on one more, which I think is very fundamental. And that is the issue of values. Values versus law. And the value of peace and that relationship of the value of peace versus law. Let me say as follows, very briefly. In terms of the question of land for peace, you have many different rabbis on different sides. And I would actually say that much of the religious Zionist movement and Rav Kook's students, like Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook and, you know, the B'nai Akiva movement and Rav Elazar Melamed and many of the modern Zionist rabbis in Israel, are very against land for peace. Whereas many American rabbis, or at least, you know, rabbis who came from outside Israel, like the Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, and even Rav Amital, who was Israeli, were more open to the notion of land for peace. They were more open to it. And part of it is a values question, in the sense of how does the general value of morality or of peace, that we want peace, that is an objective value, we want there to be peace, what role does that play in our decision making? If you look at source number, actually I lost the place here for a second, excuse me. Source number 14, I brought you a quote from Shlomo Riskin, from another more, a slightly more recent article in Tlumen from about 50 years ago or so, even more. 25 years ago or so, 25 years ago. And Rabbi Riskin essentially says, what is the ultimate question to ask? What's going to bring peace? That's the question. What is going to bring security? That's ultimately the question. The question is, land for peace depends on what will secure Israel better. If giving up land will secure Israel better, then we should do that. If it won't, we shouldn't. And he says that's a really tough thing to figure out. He says, like, I don't know. It's complex. It's bitter. The whole nation's at stake. Will a concession lead to more security, or will it weaken it? Is this the way to peace or to war? That is the question. And Professor Eliav Shochetman, who's from Israel, has a totally different perspective on this. And he writes as follows, read it in English. Discussing the question of the commandment to conquer the land according to Maimonides, where Riskin writes, among other things, there is no need to emphasize the importance of peace and that it stands above other important values. Hence, ostensibly, an opening for a permit to hand over the territories of the land to Israel to foreigners in violation of Torah prohibitions. Meaning, peace is important. Peace is really important. It's maybe the most important value. And that, in and of itself, is a reason to consider potentially violating certain Torah law in giving over the land of Israel to others. For the value of peace. And Professor Shachman says, no, that's not the way halacha works. Take a look at his thinking here. The term value, quote unquote, is not a halachic term. Halacha is a system of norms, which in halachic terminology are called mitzvot. And those are sometimes rejected due to other considerations. Only the law states that these are the cases in which a mitzvah may be rejected, just as in any system of laws. Only the law states that it is not possible to exempt from a charge or to allow a prohibited act unless the law itself so directs. It's not about values. That's his argument. You can't say there's the value of peace, and for the value of peace, we can violate the law. No, that's not how halacha operates. Halacha asks the question, is it permitted or is it not permitted? Is there a mitzvah or is there not a mitzvah? Halacha allows in certain circumstances for, not for violating mitzvot, and in certain circumstances, it doesn't allow for violating mitzvot. Simply arguing, well, for the value of peace, we can violate the Torah, is a non-starter. That's his argument here. So you have different ways of looking at this. Should we look at this from a values perspective primarily? What will bring peace? What will bring, you know, you could argue morality? Or should we look at this from perspective of what does the Torah say? Is this a circumstance in which the mitzvah to fight for Israel applies or not? Two different perspectives here. And they really are very different. I'll leave you with this quote of Rav Karmi about Rav Soloveitchik. And I think it's really interesting that I don't, as much of a halachist as Soloveitchik was, I think he thought about this differently. He writes, in 1968, the height of the euphoria that followed Israel's victory in the Six-Day War, he, meaning Rabbi Soloveitchik, ruled that decisions about concessions of land for peace should be left to military experts, not to rabbis. He said this in spite of his conviction that most of the land taken by the Israeli army is part of the biblical land of Israel and that occupying it fulfills divine commandments. His point, the safety of the current residents of Israel should be paramount. And Israel's military leaders are the most well-informed of the pros and cons of which positions to hold and which to abandon. And he continues to write, and it references the 1982, Lebanese Christian militia allied to Israel perpetrated massacres at the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps. There was a massacre by the Lebanese who were allies of Israel. This time, the Rav demanded the Prime Minister Menachem Begin appointed a commission of inquiry to investigate Israel's failure to prevent the massacres. Carnage and suffering make a plain upon a Torah-informed conscience. Do such interventions make him a liberal, as some would say? This distorts more than it clarifies. It would be more accurate to think of Rabbi Soloveitchik's political declarations as profoundly conservative. In the course of his life, he moved from the anti-Zionist to Zionist camp. But from within religious Zionism, so to speak, he criticized the transformation of politics into the anticipation of a messianic future. The point Soloveitchik is making is, don't get carried away with thoughts of Mashiach, Mashiach, Mashiach. You need to think about morality. You need to think about security and peace. Those are questions to ask to politicians, not to rabbis. So that's, I think, a totally different way of thinking. The question is, what is going to bring Israel security? Not what is permissible, what is not permissible, but based on halacha. How should a government function? Does government always turn first to Shulchan Aruch, or does it turn to its general and ask, how can we secure our borders? So I know I'm a little over time. In conclusion, I think what we see is that these questions of land over peace in Yisrael, Israel really reflect different ways of looking at the current state of Israel and our current reality. That to what, how do we answer questions relating to the state? To what degree is this a traditional question that we need to look to halachic sources and with traditional lens? And to what degree do we need to put on new glasses and look at it in a totally new reality and sort of, you know, take our sources and reconsider things? And to what degree does it need to be an all or nothing? And if we have it all, then we have it. If not, not. Then what do we say? No. Reality states that governments need to reckon with limitations. So all of these questions relate, these philosophical questions about what religious Zionism means and how should we look at the current modern state, all relate to this question of, which is really politically charged, land for peace. And let me end by saying that the hope is that ultimately we'll be able to secure our borders and live peacefully within them and not have to consider these questions. May it come very speedily. Thank you for listening.
Shukor. Shukor.